not just watch it silently like once,
Yeah.
but to like loop that sucker so many times that you hate it. Because to me, the thing that in some ways drove me away from editing, which is just the thing you want to simulate, is like, okay, so you like film
Yeah.
and you say you want to be an editor.
Yeah.
Can you watch it 25, 50 times, whatever, pick a number?
Hi, and welcome to the episode of Cine Nation. I am Brandon Sparks.
And I'm Ben Gertz.
And we're in the same room.
Oh my gosh.
Which is crazy.
It's so weird. I can't look him in the eyes. He's got two eyes.
We've never done this before. I did one episode with Thomas when we interviewed John Weinberg for a funeral day. And that's the only time I've actually been in the room with one of the other podcasters, I think.
Oh, but yeah, but you've interviewed.
I've interviewed multiple people,
right.
But like not.
It's just us that are the weirdos. Like,
it's weird. Like,
yeah.
All right.
I have nothing to report on the weather in Portland. The weather in Alabama,
it's
though.
It's rainy.
Rainy and
all over the place.
Oh, Brandon, I've ruined it for everybody. It was really nice when I landed. It was like 76.
Mm-hmm.
So, Brandon, you're eating cheesecake. We're in the same room.
We are. It's crazy.
You
gave me the cheesecake.
I did. I've set a trap.
Because your wife didn't want it.
It's a trap. There are many traps. Mm-hmm. So we have a round robin of sorts.
Yeah.
I have a couple topics that I think we can plant as like future things to discuss with the rest of the people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, because I feel like Thomas, Anna, like Hunter, we're going to get them on. Well, we're going to get them all on to like basically refute me potentially, to chastise me for being wrong. But we were chatting earlier about, basically like ways to watch films closely.
Yeah.
You know, as simple as that is, but it's like I think from the little bit of teaching that I did, some people misconstrue I watch a lot of movies with actually watching movies with the intent of learning from them.
Yeah.
Which is a very minor we're splitting a hair a little bit, but it's an important one because you're trying to not just consume. Some people talk about Tarantino working at like the video store and how he basically is just like locked in his house in sweatpants watching all these movies, right? And I've seen articles that are like that.
Like
he just locked himself away for years watching Japanese movies, you know.
These like genre like pictures.
Yeah, and that's why you get his like that's why you get his influences that people don't recognize. Basically he's remixing things we just aren't aware of.
Yeah.
And that's how he gets his, you know, special sauce that everyone loves, I guess, or some people love.
Yeah, I know you do. Well, he with like Django Unchained, like he took from Django, like a Western from the 60s.
Right.
And like a spaghetti Western. And then like with Inglourious Basterds, there's actually another movie called Inglourious Basterds that's, they're not similar at all except with the title. Mm-hmm. Even though the spelling's a little different. I think there's a difference when you watch a lot of movies. There's a difference from like you said, watching a lot of movies and like binge watching what's on Netflix, because nowadays you almost put TV and movies in the same category with like watching.
Well, I mean, quality-wise, for sure. I mean, there's a clear distinction, or somewhat, it's usually a distinction in like the structure of the story in the sense that a movie has a thing that wraps up. I don't have to tell you these things.
It's like, I know with me, like this past semester with the internships I had, I was reading not just film scripts but television scripts.
Yeah.
And while doing that, I learned a lot about TV. And then also like even like when Atlanta and the Westworld came out, like I was like
the Westworld?
Yeah, the Westworld. when Westworld,
I really like that. In-person thing is going to be my favorite, man.
when Westworld and Atlanta came out, because they kind of came out around the same time, and those were like two shows like for some reason really inspired me. Like, because I'm like, wow, this is what TV. And I know there's been like Breaking Bad and all those shows, but those were two for me. Like, oh, this is like really cool. Like, I had this conversation recently when someone asked me, like, so your dream would be to write on Atlanta? I'm like, yeah, a white guy from Alabama, I would love to write on Atlanta.
Yeah, and see, I haven't seen it, but I think I know from everything you guys have said that I would absolutely love it. And I basically like have been putting it on a shelf to say like break in case of a rainy day. Right?
Yeah.
Like,
and see, nowadays, especially with like that, that's like 10 episodes with the FX shows. Like you can literally watch that in one day because they're 30 minutes. Well, if you didn't have kids and a wife, you could watch that in one
well,
day.
Well, I mean, I think people with wives can still do it, but kids—that's
no,
thing,
yeah.
But,
I you're not the only person I know that has kids.
Right? There are more people on earth with kids. Yeah. No, I mean, part of what stopped me, right, is I just don't have an FX subscription. But I'm with you. I mean, like, there's a clear, and people have been talking about it a lot. We've talked about the show. The quality is. In a lot of ways, I mean, some of the films that I watch and some of the films we've talked about on the show, they're much lower budget, right? Yeah. They're not just like a little bit cheaper than a TV show. They're like significantly cheaper than a TV show in their production spending, right? And so it's obvious that like at some point these TV shows are like more grand and more have just more detail and more nuance and just more that they can do that you can't do in a movie, which is, you know, a turning of the tables a little bit, but it's really interesting. I mean, Westworld is insane. If you really stop, I mean, we'll have Will on to talk about it. He told me the other night when we got together that he'd watched the show through completely three times. He was considering a fourth. So I'm sure he'll have, he's writing an epic piece.
Like, I think at one point he had like three or four different epic pieces.
I hope so, because there's so much in the show to pull apart. And we haven't really talked about it here on the podcast, but
because everyone wants to talk about it, we don't want to do an episode where like
just two
people.
And I really like Will's approach when we were talking about it to really dig into the details, which is kind of what this hook is, right? Mm-hmm. Which is like, okay, so you're watching something closely. What does that actually mean? Because I think it's easy. I mean, I notice it more as I feel like my time becomes more scarce. That's like if I am doing that, I don't want to fool myself into thinking. You know, you have this idea of this 10,000 hours stuff, right? Which, you know, we could debate the science of. But, you know, loosely speaking, 10,000 hours to become a master at something. But I think some people misconstrue that as like, well, practice for a violinist, you know, is one thing. But practice for a filmmaker is just watching Netflix.
No.
Which is like, no, of course not. You and I know that. Yeah. But like, I think some people can like delude themselves into thinking, well, here I am on a Saturday sitting on my couch eating cheesecake. That's a dig at,
You gave it to me. But go back to what I was saying earlier, too. Like, there's a difference between just watching and then watching critically.
Yeah,
and
totally.
Having a critical mindset. Because I think, too, the more you watch and the more you think that way, you develop a taste for things.
Yeah.
Like, you can get more. Because like, there's certain, like, there's friends I have that I can go in depth with, like, why I liked or disliked the movie.
Right.
Or I can go, like, oh, I liked it or I disliked it. Like, with people. No offense, like that they're just like from my went to high school with me who aren't as say trained in like film.
Yeah, sure.
Like you can't give the well, I thought it lagged in this hour, which some people do get it, but like this like Rogue One, it lagged in this the middle part because of X, Y, and Z.
Right.
Like you can't always
deconstructing it in like technical terms. Yeah. And
some people can do, and some people when you watch a lot, because I have a friend. Because we talked about, and she had the same views on it from Rogue One, and she's like a nurse, but like she's watched enough where she can pick apart things. Yeah. And you also have to learn to like when you go into like say San Andreas, like when I went to see like when The Rock was in San Andreas, like I know what I'm getting into when I'm going to see that movie. I'm not expecting Citizen Kane. I'm expecting The Rock taking on an earthquake like by himself. That's what I'm expecting.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm like. To be clear, this is more, in my mind, a discussion of, like, not watching everything with some sort of, like, professorial, like, I'm going to analyze everything through this deep, you know, academic lens.
But almost how can watching stuff help you as a better storyteller and
filmmaker? Yeah, and so a couple, one of the things that I did recently that I really loved and is pretty obvious, but we'll just state it, is I read, because it's award season, basically. And weekend reads and, you know, Blacklist go into the story or go inside the story or whatever their blog is. You know, a lot of these places release the award season scripts. And so because I don't see a lot of these in theater.
You watch them.
You
read the script.
Yeah. So I read Captain Fantastic first and then watched it. And I, you know, I've read a lot after, right? It's the first time that I flipped the order and read the script first. It's a really simple thing, but I loved it because I had scenes in my mind that I built up just as a, you know, hypothetical director. How would I do this? And I was surprised in places where the film diverged from that significantly. And I thought a lot afterwards. I thought a lot after reading the script, like, wow, this is really interesting in places, kind of strange in others. And then seeing the film, thinking through that again, I had like two or three kind of rounds of reanalyzing like what do I like about this? Why didn't this work? And I think that's a particular film. You know, maybe we'll talk about it sometime, but it's one of those where it does work in some levels really, really well and then falls apart in some other key places. And it's thinking about, why is that? And I think if I had read the script after, like I normally do, I would say, well, this is just how it is. This is how it was always meant to be, you know. But anyway, that's one way, is to just read the script first.
And also, too, when you're starting out just reading scripts in general, I can tell you the scripts I had to read this past semester, like I learned a lot just from reading them. Mm-hmm. Like I could pinpoint, this is where this goes wrong right here. This is when you're having a Ex Machina style sci-fi movie, and then for some reason you turn it into a shoot 'em up like heist film. And I'm like, that's confusing. And if pulled off, like if written well, then you could pull it off with a great director. But it's like you start to learn through the stuff you've read and the stuff you've watched, like this is like this, and you don't want to make that again.
Well, I think in some ways, if you are aiming to go down this, like I'm viewing things more than normal people because I want to make things for other people, then you know that like reading the script first is a way to simulate your own mental process if you plan to direct something that you yourself haven't written.
Yeah.
Right. Because you have to construct it in your mind before it exists.
Yeah.
And the same is the other thing that I mean, you've got one, but the other one that I talked about when I was teaching editing classes, to just watch a scene silently, which is, you know, to again simulate the editing room as much as possible, where you're looping through, not with the, you know, because a lot of things get, and that's one of the great things about audio editing class or video editing class, where you dig into like really good audio editing, but you can cover up a lot of sins with great audio, and you know that once you're in it, but like to mute it and then watch, you get a real sense of rhythm, delivery. What is the underlying intent? And you have all these great resources now, like, you know, Every Frame of Painting, where he does that work for you and does it in like, you know, 20 seconds and puts all of us regular people to shame.
Yeah, and there's more than just Tony Zhao with
there. Sure.
There's so many out
there. Tons of them, right. But I mean, that's really one. And especially the thing beyond that, it's not just watch it silently like once, but to like loop that sucker so many times that you hate it. Because to me, the thing that in some ways drove me away from editing, which is just the thing you want to simulate, is like, okay, so you like film.
Yeah.
And you say you want to be an editor.
Yeah.
Can you watch it 25, 50 times, whatever, pick a number. Because that's how many times you're going to be watching it if you're cutting it with someone. And it's a lot.
Yeah, and especially sometimes if you're someone like, I know, like James Cameron, who writes, directs, and edits his own stuff.
Yeah.
So like that's been with him from like inception to the end, and people will debate if that's the right way of doing it. But even someone like Kevin Smith does that as well. Like, there's a lot of directors who do that. And
that's the wrong way to do it. James Cameron is wrong.
He only has two of the highest grossing movies of all time.
None.
But no, so I had this conversation recently with one of the guys at Cinephile. There was a movie that came out. It was called Complete Unknown with Rachel Weisz and Michael Shannon. Really good movie. I think you'd like it because it has Michael Shannon in it.
I mean, you had me at Michael Shannon.
I think it's basically her character is like taking up different identities as she goes on, like gets into a new life and becomes has a new career. And then after a certain point, she just gets tired of it and moves on to the next one. And so basically what's happening is that Michael Shannon's character, it's his birthday. She comes and meets him. And what you find out is that they were like in a relationship 15 years ago, or we're great friends, and there's something kind of there, and now all of a sudden she's come back, and he thought like she died or whatever, and she shows up at his like birthday party with now like his wife with a whole different name, and they decide to kind of have like their one last evening or an evening together or whatever. Really great movie, great performances, but there was a certain scene I was watching. And this is the thing with a lot of independent films, is it was just close up. Yeah. And I go, I'm in New York City, and I see none of New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And it might just be a preference thing, but I go, if I mute this, I don't know what's happening.
But see, here's one of those things, right?
There's no shot progression to it, was the other thing.
Okay,
too.
But I mean, when you put on your producing hat, like, do you think that...
Yeah,
this is where you think through, like, is that because of, like, you know, constraints of... Did they have shooting permissions?
That happens. Like, you see with a lot of independent films, like, you don't see wide shots because...
Yeah.
they don't have the time or money to do that.
Right.
With me, I try to always get wide shots because I like them.
Right.
And I know when you get to the, when you're watching it, like with Kent Nichols, I'll say this for example, is like even in Hartley, to the last two films I directed, two shorts, we would do wide shots that were like lighting buildings or lighting woods or whatever, and they'd take 2 hours. And I can see where that would be like a hassle and would just screw with your schedule so much.
Right.
And like, I know I, my director, my cinematographer, Mark, like, I know he can get like, we're lighting night exteriors with like four lights in the middle of the woods with a generator. Like, it's crazy, but at the end of the day, when we watch that movie now, every time I've watched with Professor at USC, they get to that shot, they go, this is just beautiful. Like, this just adds so much to your movie and so much to the scene. And that's something that you have to realize what's important to the story, and can you deal with losing those 2 hours or whatever?
Yeah, sure.
Like, because even that wide shot is like in Camp Nichols is like 6 seconds, and you hear, like, you've seen it, like, it's the one you talked about. It's like you don't hear any dialogue, but I think it's important for that scene to have, and you have to try your best to get that and fight for that if you can. And so, or even if you don't have enough time to get that, have some sort of shot progression. Like, even I think Adam Salkey, because he was my professor at USC that we had on the show about a year ago, he like showed a scene, I think from a couple scenes from Notorious with Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman. And there was a conversation scene that was all just in pretty much a two shot the entire time. And then, and it's Hitchcock that directed it. And then it cuts into a close up as a very important story beat. And then a close up to the next character. They go back and forth and it cuts back out to the two shot. So in that 5 minute scene, there's three shots or three setups.
Right.
But those two close ups were important for the story.
Right.
And so Hitchcock would always say, I want to be able to mute or take the sound out and know what's going on. And I think that's a lot of problems with independent films nowadays that people kind of don't talk about.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Hitchcock, right? I mean, any of these...
trying to diss independent film, because I think there's great films out there.
Yeah, and that's a, you know, that's a broad, cheap shot. But, you know...
Thank you.
Well, no, but you definitely have, you know, people more closely anchored to the silent era who are advocating that, right? Where clearly it's like, it is an art form that should speak without sound in some ways, right? And I think there's plenty of, you know, there's, so depending on this, like which technique you use, right? It's like, which thing are you wanting to hone? Are you wanting to hone... Because the other thing you notice with the sound out, right, is you notice lighting a lot more.
Yes.
Because you're looking more closely at... And really, I mean, so then the next question is like, okay, are you wanting to be like a colorist or a DP? Because in that case, you probably want to freeze frame.
Yeah.
You probably want to pause and just really think about like, what is this composition? Like in this moment, why?
Yeah.
Why does this exist?
Mm-hmm. And that's, I do that sometimes. I know Mark that you know, that no one else on the show knows.
We'll bring him on. He's a nice guy.
Yeah, he's great. But he does screen grabs. And as a cinematographer, I know a lot of cinematographers that do that. They do screen grabs.
Right.
Ooh, I love the lighting of that. And they want to take that screen grab and then analyze.
Well, and when I was doing color, teaching color classes and just for my own use, I would do screen grabs for color.
Yeah.
Because it's a really simple way to say, how are they really getting this color palette? Mm-hmm. You know, and a really simple one is just like Transformers. Like, you know, and it's often cited and you know, widely, you know, talked about. It's just like, you know, they have this ridiculous, egregious, like, you know, teal and orange, teal and orange, teal and orange, you know, and there's some great breakdowns of how they do that with our, you know, production design, with the clothes they choose, with the backgrounds, with what they light, how they light it, you know, but to have those stills and have put them in some sort of mood board or, you know, I was using Evernote years ago, something so that you can quickly just say, oh yeah, like I'm thinking of like The Dark Knight. What are those things in The Dark Knight, like stylistically, lighting wise, where you can freeze it, take a screen grab and look at it and say, where is, like, where's the light coming from, you know?
Yeah.
And to me, it's just like, yeah, it's just a question of what do you want to hone? Like, are you wanting to be a crazy person that does it all?
Yeah.
Like, you know, do you want to be James Cameron and you want to write, direct, you know, edit? Or is it that you want to be an editor? Because if you want one of those things, it's a particular way of viewing.
And I think, too, not even if you decide you want to be, like, say, with me, I want to be, like, writer director. The thing is, like, I know enough about, and I edit as well, I know enough about editing or cinematography to where I can have a conversation with the person that is working with me. And that's, I think, one of the biggest things people need to learn is, like that if, like with Mark, because like, he'd be an example, is that, like, I'll give him films to watch, and he'll take what I, from watching that, what he thinks the mood will be and, like, what we've kind of discussed. And so we don't have much of a conversation on set because we've already had that conversation before.
Right.
And we have that same terminology. And, like, I understand, we both understand there needs to be a purpose for all of it unless we're trying to do a stylized thing. Mm-hmm. Like, sometimes you can do stylized and you're, like, because sometimes you'll watch a movie and go, that makes no sense of where that light's coming in. You have, like, the light coming in from one window for sun's, like, for sun, and then light coming in from the other window on the opposite side. And you're like, that's not possible, but it but it works for the scene or whatever.
Yeah.
Like that happens sometimes where I can't remember what the example that I'm thinking of, but I remember I was watching a scene from Notting Hill, and that's I like that movie. I'm a sucker for like romantic comedies. In all honesty, there's a scene where they're sitting at a table. It's like it's a dinner party or whatever, and there's candles everywhere around the table. I'm like, oh, that's should look beautiful. It's just candle lights. But I'm watching and go, it's just all top light. It's just all like looks like fluorescence from the top. And I'm like, why the hell do you have all these candles here? It's just to create a cool effect of production design. I'm like, you should have gone like full blown, make it like it's a candle lit dinner with just a lot of candles, like Barry Lyndon or whatever.
Right.
But instead it was just flat because of the lighting that was coming from the ceiling, basically.
Yeah, and I think all those, I mean, if you are aiming to direct or to DP or even a colorist or editor, right, to build up, if you build up those stills and you think through them as you kind of, because, you know, you'll look at them and then you break it down way more than you would if you're just watching it through the first, second, third time. But by having groups of those, you can compare dinner scenes across other movies.
Yeah.
Because it's really, like, it's really hard to actually, you know, do that in your, it's imp- in almost your head. Impossible in your head. Because you're like, oh, well, there's a dude sitting at a table with candles.
Yeah.
But when you really can just pull up two stills next to each other and go, oh, these are remarkably different. Why? Yeah. You know, and I noticed that a lot with color, just the subtleties of it in ways. And I never got great at it. And I kind of thought, well, if I'm going to go down this path, this is a very deep rabbit hole to go down. Mm-hmm. But there's so much nuance and subtlety in what you're accentuating, especially now with the tools available to manipulate it after you've lit it. You know, where you put your power windows to bring out someone's, you know, whether or not you accentuate their cheekbones in post in by tracking their cheeks or something. Right? There's just a million ways to alter it. And why would you do that? Or, you know, what are some other films where you think you can spot some of those things being done?
Well, it's like, I know, for example, we did that with Camp Nichols where we took multiple screen grabs of like fire scenes of trying to figure out the best way to do a fire scene.
Yeah.
And because then you look at Stand By Me, and I'd watch a lot of these movies. That was one thing I did right before Camp Nichols was I just watched a bunch of movies I grew up with or had something in it that was a style that we could steal from, even if it was like Mighty Ducks or like some random 90s kids movie. I was like, what can we steal from that? Like, why does this work for this movie or why doesn't it work? But like, we looked at Stand By Me for a campfire scene. We looked at, I think, My Own Private Idaho for Stand By Me or for a fire scene. I think we even looked at another like random camp movie called Indian Summer, like all these different things. Like, okay, how did they light this? How does it work? Is the light just the fire, or is it fire and moonlight or some other artificial light or whatever? And so that's something that I just,
well, and to toot your horn, you and Mark, though, I mean, the that's a great in Camp Nichols, that's lit really, really well.
Yeah,
right, because that you watch enough of those scenes in other movies and you see it done wrong and it screams murder. You're like, oh gosh, this is terrible. And Camp Nichols is not like that.
Well, thank you.
That's a compliment.
Well, I give a lot of that to Mark because, because I think you were on Hartley like last year, and seeing just how we've progressed over time and to where him and I don't have to talk that much. Like, I thought we talked a lot, and I have to be like, you guys like never talk on set.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, okay. I guess because we have that, like, we can say three words and we know what we're talking about. and we had that kind of same terminology and like same kind of knowledge of movies or TV or whatever, and like mm-hmm. what we can steal from, because you're just stealing constantly. But now, like with him,
everything
like,
is a remix.
Yeah, well, it's like we had a scene in that campfire scene. I'll just reveal this thing right now. But we had, and we learned this from Hartley, and why a certain scene didn't work was that we had someone standing. It was a conversation scene. We had someone standing, and it was the night you were there. But there was nothing behind them but the street, and we couldn't light the street because it was just too dark. And we didn't have enough light, so. When you watch the scene, something fills off, and that's because there's nothing in the background. It's just the actor standing in front of a black car, and behind him is just a black, basically looks void. Like a, yeah, nothing.
Yeah.
And with Camp Nichols, we had a similar scene where we had a character sitting, and it was just nothing, a black void behind him, and we were like, what do we do? And Mark's like, we have to rotate the entire set this amount of degrees to get trees in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And so... It doesn't. It, you won't catch it if like, unless you're like looking like when you're watching. You're like, oh, this doesn't make sense. The geography of the scene, but we had to literally move the chairs over more to the left to get trees coming in to where it wasn't just a void. And that's something I think from watching stuff and also having on-set knowledge of like when it didn't work, because that same scene going off you're talking about earlier about like. Watching something with it with the sound off, that same scene wasn't working at all. I was like, why in the hell is this scene not working? It was too fast, it was too slow, and I realized I was cutting to the audio and not the picture.
Yeah.
And so I went back and muted it, and I edited it from just the visuals, and then when I did that, I go, oh, that works a lot better.
Yeah,
let me play with the audio a little bit.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, that's just from being able to watch so much stuff and realize there's something's wrong here, and you have to diagnose the problem.
Yeah, you're trying to build up a sense of intuition.
Yeah.
Right, which comes through just repetition, mm-hmm. right, which is part of that 10,000 hours. But the... I don't even like that. Whatever. You're trying to build up over a long course of effort.
You have to work practice. A lot at it is basically what it means. Because, like, someone's... I don't think anyone is logging their 10,000... I did... this today, that today, and once I hit 10,000, I'm Steven Spielberg, or I'm Kurosawa. And the thing about those guys is that they'll probably tell you they don't have it figured out yet. Like, that's what makes them great. I think it was, like, Kurosawa and Bergman that had, like, one was wishing the other one a happy birthday, and it was towards the end of their lives, and they're like, yeah, one day we'll figure this stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, this is Bergman and Kurosawa, who made some, like, the greatest films of all time, and they don't even know sometimes what they're doing.
Right.
But it's just through, I think it's just, that's being successful, especially within, say, directing or whatever, I think is half watching and being able to analyze stuff, and then half of it is having that, like, on-set experience.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that you just said that is interesting, right, is the cheating, this mm-hmm. idea that, like, you rotated the set to cheat it, and I think... I remember growing up where there was this whole, and this is still a thing some people fixate on, but it's like movie trivia about continuity errors, which I, you know, it's almost this, it's this naive idea that you can like catch Hollywood making these huge mistakes where like they didn't notice, right? And it's really not that at all in most cases. Mm-hmm. In a big budget movie, it's not, I mean, before CGI could fix anything and everything, including dead actors not being able to be in movies, you know, you had Gladiator or something or Braveheart where a truck drives across the horizon or whatever, right? And so you have people like, oh, look at these stupid mistakes. But really, as an editor or even a director, you're realizing, okay, what murder can I get away with? Because most people don't know. And that's why it's like trivia is because it's most people don't give a shit.
No.
Most people don't care. And
we cuss on this show all the time.
There's no schoolmaster to scorn me, but
we'll put the E on the iTunes and make sure everyone knows.
Oh my gosh! But it's knowing what you can get away with. If there's anything to learn from some of those, you see some of the scenes where there are quote unquote continuity errors, or you watch some stuff, even things like merch and some of these great like editors. I mean, they will intentionally like create like they will allow massive murders to take place in a scene to get to the heart of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is what that repeated watching will give you, because you come back and you go, oh my gosh, this doesn't even begin to make sense that this happens in this way, but it works. The first and second and third time I saw it, it's that fourth time where I go, oh, that's weird.
And I can say, like, because I read Murch's In a Blink of an Eye just for fun.
Great book.
And it is, no, it is. And, like, continuity is, like, on his list of, like, 10 things, it's, like, number 8 of, like, what you should be looking for.
Yeah.
And that's something I know a lot of, I mean, I was the same way, a lot of young filmmakers, they, like, oh, well, this doesn't make sense because... In this shot, he was... This actually happened. This shot, he was sitting down, and that shot... Or, I'm sorry. That shot, he's standing up, and the next shot, he's sitting down.
Right.
And I go, I don't care. Yeah. I'm like, I cut from him in a wide shot standing up. I cut to a close-up of her. I cut... They're arguing, and I cut to a close-up of him, and he's sitting down. I was like, in all honesty, if you're into the story, no one's going to notice that.
Yeah, and I mean, that's one of those things where I think because I had been so fixated at it when I was younger, I paid a lot of attention to it to my detriment when I was cutting. I would cut to continuity too many times and catch myself later going, this scene is terrible.
Yeah.
And I know why it's terrible is because I was focused on the wrong thing. I was focused on continuity when that's not at all important. So I mean,
it feels right. It needs to be what feels right.
Yeah, and it's almost in some ways what I, you know, what I realized too from teaching is that it's the easiest thing to teach.
Yeah,
because it is so textbooky. It's very much like quizzable. It's it's a thing where you can say like, can you pass the test of continuity? And so there are some like editing professors or you know, and I myself did it sometimes early on where I'd be like, you know, this really simple thing, this rubric is broken.
Yeah,
because you can very quickly point it out. But the much stronger, like, teaching direction and feedback and thing that's harder to teach is to completely ignore that and get to the heart of what's broken in a scene, which is hard. You know, it's difficult when you have 10, 15 students in a room and you're trying to, like, spend 2 minutes to say, why is this broken?
Yeah.
You know, but you have to be willing to kind of, like, move beyond that and move past the easy answer, basically, to help people see the underlying idea.
And with continuity, too, some directors just love messing with it. Like, I know Scorsese's like that. Like, I was watching Goodfellas, and there was in one scene when Leota and I think De Niro talking to, like, one of the big mob guys that helps Leota out. It's just, like, one scene, or in the close-up of him, he has a cigar, like, smoking, and then in the, over the shoulder where you see his face, no cigar. Or, like, the water in Shutter Island, the water's changing constantly or whatever.
Right.
It's, like, weird things like that where Scorsese likes doing that, and it's a choice. But you just have to kind of find out what's working or what's not working, and continuity needs to be thrown out the window. Because I know that was a lot of teachers at USC with editing where it was, like, cut with what feels right.
Right.
And or I like cutting kind of on rhythm of like,
which is the if you read Murch, right? I mean, that's his whole thing of he plays it back in real time.
Yeah,
doesn't play it double speed, half speed, doesn't go frame by frame. He plays it from the top of the clip, rolls it out, stops it when he feels right, plays it back again, sees if he can hit the same spot. If he hits the same frame to the frame or within a couple is what he says basically. You know, then that's his cut. If not, he keeps searching.
Yeah,
which is maniacal, like the,
and that's kind of what I do when I edit, is the thing.
I have definitely tried that path. I mean, there's different modes of editing, right? The commercial editing that I've done, a lot of times you don't have that time, but in the times where I've tried to follow that for a narrative piece or something I'm working on, I'm like, oh my gosh, I am so tempted by frame by frame. And that's where I get into that continuity thing, because you're going, oh well, his hand's up here, and if I cut on the hand movement, that'll feel more natural, and it will. The continuity of motion will be like a cheap exit, like it's a cheap trick, but you're not getting the heart of it.
Because I know he like will
preaching
stand
to myself.
Yeah, he will stand. I know he's because in when there is a good behind the scenes thing of him editing Cold Mountain, where you kind of saw his setup and he's like standing up and like moving constantly.
Final Cut 7.
Yeah,
he had Final Cut 7 and a projector, and he's a standing desk.
And that was the thing about him too, was that what he does is that he's always trying to be like one step ahead of everything. So he was like, he went to digital editing pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And even though he's still big on film, because I think he came to USC when he did a screening of Return to Oz, which was like the only movie he ever directed, and like how he wants to like do a video of teaching people how to work on Moviola because it's becoming so digital, no one will know how to work on Moviola.
I mean, it's ancient history now, basically. Yeah,
unless you are from that time period. And so he wanted to, like, do a video of, like, showing you how to work that because no one cuts on film anymore. Like, Saving Private Ryan, which I think, I don't know if he did it, it might be another person did that, but they cut, that was, like, one of the last few films that cut on film. It's just you have to learn what the heart of it is, and I think Merch is a good one that kind of does that. And what's interesting about Merch is that he mostly did audio. Like, he does picture, but his start of his career was, like, mostly all audio.
Yeah, there's a really, I mean, so his book, In the Blink of an Eye, is, like, what I used as my textbook for the editing class. But
which a lot of people do.
Yeah, I mean, sure, it's like, standard issue.
It's kind of the Bible for editing.
I mean, it's a very simple answer. But he's got another really compelling book that you don't see as often. We'll put it in the show notes if I can get to it. But basically, it's a conversation that he had with, I believe it's just a journalist. The conversations, Walter Merchant, The Art of Editing Film. It's excellent because it's...
What was this?
This has been out for years. I bought this years ago and, let's see, published, I don't know, 2004.
Okay.
It's excellent. Paperback, I don't think they have there might be a Kindle of it. Anyway, doesn't matter. Yeah, it's paperback. It's really, really good because you get into, just as a Merch nerd, like you get into his, like, what motivates him, and you get into his history, too, of audio and also just, like, the other random hobbies that he does. I mean, he translates poetry from, like, the dude is eccentric, you know,
and that
to a very extreme level. I mean, if not just outright genius.
And that sounds very much like, because I've been watching the masterclass stuff of, like, Aaron Sorkin and Werner Herzog, and Herzog is one of those guys where he's just like, I learned editing from Icelandic poetry, and he gets a book and reads it, and he's just like, that's beautiful stuff. It's beautiful. He doesn't say stuff. That's not Werner's way. But he's like, it's beautiful. And he's like talking about learning editing from that. And I'm going, what is this guy talking about? I'm like, he's a genius. Like, it's just like, it's so crazy. But it's just like, he talks about directing and being a storyteller. He's like, all you need to do is, he's like, read over and over. He goes, read. He's like, all the great filmmakers, they read constantly. And you're like, okay. And
yeah, that's interesting.
But, so I want to ask you this question. So as a teacher, what was some of the hardest stuff you had to do, like teaching, editing?
Students. You know, I think the benefit of what I was doing, the reason like departments like Alabama and USC bring in like working professionals, right? Is like I worked by day and then came in and taught at night.
Yeah.
And the thing that I loved about teaching, editing in particular, was, you know, you take something that you do almost every day, you know, as a you're being paid by someone to do this.
Yeah.
And then you have to stop and think about, no, wait a minute. Okay, no, I have to teach this to someone else. Why is it I'm actually doing this? Like, how do I even articulate what it is I'm thinking about as I'm working through this, right? So that simple act of, well, not a simple act, but that going back to the foundational ideas of why am I cutting at this rhythm? You know, what's motivating all this? I found that just extremely interesting. And that was... basically worth the price of admission of being
a
moderately paid teacher.
Well, you're an adjunct. Like,
an adjunct. It's not a get-rich-quick scheme, let's be clear. but yeah, I love that because it forced me to look through Merch and to look through some of, like, why do I love this film? What, you know, who are the great editors that I look up to? But yeah, the tough thing that I tried to do, and I got better at it as I taught, you know, 5, 6, 7 different times. Mm-hmm. You know, I tried to work. I was a little bit outside the norm of the department, I think. You know, mainly because I just kind of did what I wanted in a lot of ways.
Yeah, well, and you taught at night. You didn't only have an office, probably.
Yeah, I didn't have an office. I didn't show up for department meetings. You know, like, they didn't really seem to care. So
you came 2 nights a week for 3 hours.
And so basically what I would do, though, what I came to do towards the end that I really found useful, and I think, you know, I hope, like, some of the people I taught have really, like, gone and done way cooler things than I've done, you know, today. And you know, I took students who were really exceptional in a lot of cases. Some of the people were just like really already working on great stuff.
Yeah.
And I didn't say to them like, look, you clearly are really talented. Let me give you this intro assignment.
Yeah.
Because that's part of the syllabus. I took everybody and I said, okay, if you're already pretty far along, my goal is not to like bring you back to the starting line where everybody else is. I want to give you like, tell me what it is you want to get better at, and I'll try and shape something. The projects in particular, I would say, okay, look, you can bring your own. If you have a short film you're working on, that can count as your assignment if it meets these basic requirements. So I wouldn't not everyone had to cut the same stock footage that I brought in from like previous classes. But yeah, for the intro people who are like, I don't know how to use a computer, which there's some of those people, then you have to say, here's how you use a computer. Here's a lynda.com course, which doesn't even exist anymore, I guess. Or got bought out by LinkedIn. But anyway.
Oh, is it really done? Well, dang.
Well, now it's like rebranded or whatever. But anyway, I would give them an online course and I'd say, look, I'm going to, in the class, we're going to have workshop time to work through problems. Bring your problems. Bring what you need help with. But you need to go catch up with everybody else and watch this course on how to use Final Cut or whatever. Because the tool isn't critical. Like, it's not structured to just Final Cut 7. That doesn't matter. It's the word tool agnostic. You're going to just have to get up to speed on how to use it so that we can have these broader conversations about cutting just a scene, cutting a sequence, cutting a short, you know. And so it's, you know, trying to take everybody and just move them a little bit further ahead of where they are. And so not everybody is anchored to the same place, which makes it, I was only able to do that because I'd have 10 students. If I had 100, you know, or whatever, forget it. Everyone would have been cookie cutter. But because it was usually 8 to 10, and a lot of times, honestly, you'd have people who didn't care that much.
Yeah.
And for those people, you say, look, here's the grading rubric. I also was one of the people who was like, this is against, I'm pretty sure against like campus policy. I have no idea, but
You're not there anymore.
But you know, my attendance policy was if you can't get motivated to be here, I can't. I'm not going to try and motivate you. Your motivation is, and I would give them the number on the whiteboard. I'd say this class, if you're in state, costs you X amount of dollars. If you're out of state, which is bananas, it costs you this much money. If that doesn't motivate you, and you would rather go watch a movie or hang out with friends or sleep, I'm not going to be able to fix that for you. That's you between you and your parents and your like student loans that you'll have to pay off. That worked for some people, and for others, honestly, it just meant other people went away and, you know, send me nasty emails if you disagree with that. But that basically, for people who cared, I pushed them to do even better work. And I don't know. I think that's kind of the thing you have to do in the field. There's not anyone later on after you graduate who's like, come on, Brandon, you need to turn in your short film so you can submit it to film festivals. Like, no one cares. Once you're done,
yeah,
you have to have some sort of internal drive to get it done.
Yeah, and going off that too, because that kind of going, no one's going to tell you like to turn your short film into a festival or whatever. A lot of filmmakers I know, they want to make sure everything's perfect. And they want to like, I'm not going to turn it in a short film unless it's perfect.
Yeah.
And with scripts, you can kind of get that, but still, it's never going to be perfect. And with films especially, like, I know I've multiple times where like I'd be watching something we did and we're showing it at a film festival and I go, oh, there's a boom mic. Never saw that before until today. Guess it's going to just stay in there.
Yeah.
Like you can't do anything about it. And I think if you become so attached to it and trying to make it perfect, you end up, you miss that window of releasing it or whatever.
If there's anything that's kind of anchored to that 10,000 hours idea, it's just a learning cycle. And that's, you know, we're at a football school, right? But you have a really simple analogy in their situation where you practice all week, you play the game, and then the next day on Sunday, you watch film of that game to learn to then repeat the cycle to play another game.
Yeah.
And I think that's like, you know, I'm not speaking from a ton of like personal, like this is how I've lived my life, but it's like in the times where I have done projects, this is what I've tried to do, which is you don't really get a sense of what you've made until it's out in the world. And you let it go, and then you watch it that like 2 months later, like you said, at a festival or at a friend's house or whatever, and you go, oh my gosh. I mean, I had that with the web series that we worked on where I realized, holy cow, I spent all this time writing, directing, and editing, and I got a month later, and I go, there's a minute, a minute in this opening pilot that is just total fluff that could be gone. And you don't know it until it's out in the world. And you, and so then it's like, okay, now I'm better prepared to go back and edit those next round of scripts because I don't need that fluff that I didn't realize was fluff until you
yeah.
you have to learn that thing.
Yes.
And there's no other way to learn it. Like, no. you could have told me, like, Ben, you don't need this. And I said, no, Brandon, I need this.
And I did tell you that.
And you did. And you did. And people told me that. And I was like, no, I need this. And then it hit me like a ton of bricks where I was like, oh, my gosh.
Cut that.
And I didn't say Brandon was right. I just thought, like, I had this insight that came from nowhere.
Yeah. You were saying I was wrong, but no one was right. you just have to get it out into the world and be able to take criticism. That's one thing I've had with people that I know where I gauge if it's my first time working with them in some way, like giving them script notes or whatever. I gauge and see if I can give them a very very simple note and see how they take it. Because some people can't, like, they just can't take notes.
No, it's true. Yeah.
It's like I've had some things where I go, you know, this, you really should, like, name the character. You really should, like, give me, like, a trait where, like, it makes this character different from the other characters. And the thing, they go, well, there's a reason why it's like that. And I go, I'm not going to give you my main stuff then. Because if that simple note, you can't say, oh, I'll think about that. That's a good point. Like, I'll think about it. If you can't even say that, if you go, here's the reason why I did that and why it's staying that way. How can I tell you, well, your act two isn't working, your act three isn't working, you're not building up this, like, you're not getting any character development, I don't know what's going on. Like, if you start doing that, like, you'll just break them. And it's also, like, I don't want to waste my time doing that. And Grant, I'm in film school, like, I know everything, but you have to be able to take that criticism. And even if that person is wrong, I have people that I admire. Even you sometimes, well, you'll give me a critique.
You don't
that,
admire me, Brandon.
No, I do. I admire you. And, like, you give me a critique, and I'm like, well, that's not right. And I'll go, oh, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. But then sometimes, the other thing that you'll say, like, that will happen, where you'll say that, and I'm like, that's not right. I'm not going to do that. And then you get, if you're right in the script process, you get five drafts later. You go, oh, wait, that's actually a good point now.
Mm-hmm.
I need to put that in there.
Yeah.
Like, and that's happened with a lot of the scripts I've done where I think you or some other person will say this, and I go, that person's crazy. That'll never work. And then five drafts later, oh, that's – you have to keep that in your mindset. Because I was listening. Even though I didn't agree with it, I was listening to it. And it came back and helped me later.
And that's the key, right, is that you have to at least at a minimum be able to hear it without freaking out.
Yeah.
That's like – that is like level one of can you take criticism. There's a bunch of levels above that.
Yeah.
You know, and the biggest – that biggest one, though, is just can you listen without your defenses being riled up to the point where you want to attack the other person?
Yeah.
Because that's really what you're looking for, like you said, is does the person not only dismiss it but also, like, attack back and say, well, you're wrong because of this?
Yeah.
And that's – I never – like, there's anything that I regret about my time in LA when I was doing the, you know, the short film school thing, but it was like, it was that inability to take criticism without it, you know, it would just destroy me.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, because we were on such short cycle times, we were doing three short films over, like, each one was 3 weeks. So it was brutal. Yeah. As you were presenting your final cut of your first film, you were then in the same class pitching your new idea for your second one. And that was just so brutal to take really, you know, I think for one of them, the feedback was basically like, you know, the notes from the other students were like, what do they like? And they were like, because you had to do a sandwich or whatever, positive, negative.
Yeah, the.
So silly. But, you know, you kind of need it because people are so sensitive about it.
Yeah.
But it was like, we like the music, you know? And I just, like, all like, I...
it's temp.
All I can remember from that feedback session is that they like the music. I don't remember
the negative stuff.
What was ultimately probably really valuable. Like, I didn't take notes. You know what I mean? I was just so floored by getting this negative feedback that it just, like, hooked onto me and drug me down. And I think that is just a huge flaw of something to be able to, like, improve on personally. But you see it with other people, right? Where you're like, you gotta fix this.
And it's almost better if you can't take that than just not get feedback at all. If that makes sense. It's like, I've had professors, when they see a student who's just, like, really worried and, like, really on the edge, like, I don't know what you're saying. And I had one professor go, look, I'm not going to tell you my notes in front of everyone. We'll do it after class if you really want to know. But I can tell that if I do it, you won't be able to, like, it'll hurt you too much. Because you feel like you're in, like, this public shaming thing.
Yeah, and so that is, like, a personality thing, right? Because, like, there's that. I mean, for me, I think it's not necessarily, like, I'm a bad person. It's, like, for me, it is this group shaming thing, yeah. right? So it's like, I don't really like that. Not mm-hmm. a little, not a lot of people do.
No.
But there are certain types of people, right, that can't, like, will probably never be able to handle it, but could still be really great filmmakers.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, it is like, try, if you are trying to get feedback, set yourself up to get it in a way that you can hear it. So if that is like, please write your notes in a nice email in this format. You know, even giving people like a, you know, because you see this at like test screenings, will it give you a formatted page of like, these, you know, what's the best character, what's the weakest character, whatever. If that's what you want, favorite, like, maybe do that. But you need some way to get it without it being just, you know, mind-melting where you just shut down.
Yeah, I'll tell this story real quick. My first film I ever did at USC, I did this, like, it was like, you do like a 3-minute film, you spend $100 on it, and they're just like, take it as like an exercise. It's not a film, take it as an exercise. I'm like, okay, it's just an exercise. And I go and make this little bitty thing in my apartment that like it's, I'm doing the assignment. And I start watching the other films that are being shown. I go, oh shit, these are good. Mine's terrible compared to these. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh man. And then like on the last day of like when they're showing stuff and they show one, I'm like, oh, that was kind of bad. And then when I'm thinking that one was bad, like they're like, oh, we loved it. And I go, shit. And it comes to me and they show my film and it's just like lights come up, dead silent. And they're like golf clap. And like, okay, comments. And one guy, Thomas's roommate, Ethana, he's like, I really liked this or whatever. I don't know what it was.
Yeah. But
it was like very like, I like this one. Okay, good. Yeah, yeah. And then when someone raises their hand, they go, yeah, I don't know what you did here. And they're like, well, you're really talented in class and you have this great eye, but we didn't see any of that in this film. And then someone goes, yeah, I agree with that. I think you, and it's like just like boom, boom, like bombs are like going, I go, why did I come to USC? Mm-hmm. And I had like the TA, the student assistant or whatever. He's like, okay, now your thoughts, because it was basically students, TA, professors, how the thing went. And the TA comes up, who I've known for a few weeks, he goes, I'm not upset, I'm just disappointed in what you did. And I go, oh god.
Yeah.
And then it comes to the professor, who's now like my mentor and like one of my big mentors. He goes, I don't really know your work, I don't really know you that well, but like apparently they all think you're talented, but I didn't see any of that in this movie. And he's just like, there was no voice, there was nothing, like, it was just, it was, there was nothing here, and I don't know what you were doing. And I go, why did I come to USC? Why did I come to film school? Why did I move to LA?
Yeah.
And then it was like the day, it took me a day, and I go, okay, what do I do? Do I make a better film, or do, like, what do I need to do to learn from this? And it was like, okay, I'm going to focus more on the next film I do. I spent more time. I had the professor give me notes in the script. He didn't give me much because he was like, he didn't want to hurt my feelings because he just saw my first terrible film that I did.
Yeah.
And then I shot it. And he's like, this is one of the best films of this semester. And I think he used it the next semester with a couple other films to like teach incoming students how to make a film at USC with the amount of money they had.
Yeah.
And that one like went to Austin Film Festival and played at certain places. And so that was like me coming back from a major failure. And I think that's the best way to is try your best to learn from it, not take it personal, especially in like this industry, and just move on from it.
Yeah, I mean, I try and I take that same, now mm-hmm. I take that similar approach, not at the time when I was in film school, but I try and use it as fuel for the next time. I mean, because there's a really, you can use it as a rocket that you strap to yourself that's pointed down.
Yeah.
And you just race to the, you know, the bottom of the canyon and you think, I'm a terrible human. Or you can use it as some sort of spark to say like, all right, I'm going to find a way to move these notes towards the next thing that I do. And you know, that with the web series thing that we both worked on, you know, that was, there was both modes in my mind, right? Where I'm like, oh, I'm a terrible person that I got this wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's like, man, okay, so I could use this. You know, if I can find a way to keep myself from being super negative, there's a way to make this better.
Yeah.
And that you have to, however you, you know, get there, you have to find a way to do that, to keep yourself sane and not make it, not make it personal. I mean, it's really tough, I think, if you make, if you say to people, I want to be a filmmaker, you're anchoring so much of your self identity on that thing.
Yeah.
And if they don't like your film, you then very quickly say they don't like me and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. You know, so it's tough. Like, I think that's why you listen to Script Notes and, you know, Craig Mazin has a film that's in theaters and then gets bad reviews and he's down in the dumps.
Mm-hmm.
And he has his own different approach to it, you know, and they talk through their own, like, mental states of critical reviews and all these sorts of things. But I think critical reviews from strangers is one thing, but being able to take feedback from friends or people you respect, you have to find a way to let that into your, like, guarded, you know, missile defense against, because there is there is genuine, like, just haters gonna hate, YouTube comments, like, some stranger you don't know that's like, dude, your web series sucks, you know, that doesn't, like, that feedback is not feedback.
No, it's not,
that's just hate.
That's just hate.
But someone who's like, this music choice is terrible, that's not worded well, but it's important because maybe it is a terrible music choice. You don't know in the moment. You're going to just think, that person, I hate that person.
Yeah.
Maybe.
And
maybe all of you listening are just better people than us. I don't think so.
And another thing, too, is that you, if you get a note like, oh, this part's terrible, this part doesn't work, it might not be that part that's not working.
Exactly.
It might be a part that's 3 minutes before. You might
Yeah, that's the tough
well.
Thing to parse out, right?
Yeah. That's very tough to learn. But going back to all the way back to why we wanted to do this episode, because we kind of gone all over the place. It was saying that I'd watched X amount of movies this past year was the whole reason for the, it was, I think I've watched 217 this past year with like 9 TV shows.
Seasons.
Plus, 9 seasons, yeah. And then plus like internships and work or
you actually
classes.
Crawl out of bed and live in the world.
I'm only making fun of that. No, it's fine. It's what's in like the my junior year in college, I watched like, I think I said 426 movies and a few TV seasons.
So honestly, this is almost it's not, there's many reasons, but it's one of the reasons that I kind of moved away from full-time editing. Thinking about directing in a way. I never really thought too much about directing, really. It was more about editing. Mm-hmm. But I, like, even at my peak in college, was watching nearly that many movies. And now, you know, with work and life and everything, like, I think my Letterboxd account diary thing says I've watched, like, 15 films this year, 20 films. I don't know. I think I've missed a few here and there. I think it's up more than that, but 20, 30 maybe, whatever, at the most. But just thinking about, like, I have never had that sense to watch that many.
Yeah.
So this is my question to you, Brandon. Because this is how I kind of think about it in my own head. Is like, what is it you feel like? Because we just talked about watching films deeply.
Yeah.
But what is it you feel like? Are you that includes some rewatches and all these things?
Yeah.
Things. But
yeah.
I mean, what do you feel like you're taking away from that much? I mean, because the negative
content,
way to say it would be was like consumption, right?
Yeah.
That much, like, just plugged into your brain.
Yeah.
What do you feel like you're taking away from a year of...
That was the problem when I did the 400, because I called it the 400 project or whatever, and you got to a point where everything kind of blended together. Like, did I watch that movie?
Yeah.
Especially if they're not good.
Yeah.
Like, if they're mediocre, and they just blend together of like, wait, I did watch that movie. What the hell happened in that movie? What I've learned, I guess it helps... as a director, just to see how other directors do certain things and tackle certain things. You don't always notice that in the first time you watch it, so that's why I also rewatch stuff. I have some friends like, oh, you should just watch stuff you've never seen before and get the knowledge. And I agree that you need to watch stuff you haven't seen before. But I feel like with me, that first time I'm watching to be entertained.
Yeah.
The second time is analytical in a way.
Right.
And so that's why I prefer like rewatching stuff to see why did I like that to begin with, does it still hold up or whatever. I think the big thing is just what I've learned is just you see how to tell a story, like, and how not to tell a story sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Or how, I think it was, because it was Sorkin and his thing was talking about how you need to be able to be a diagnostician to go and pinpoint the problems. And I think the only way you can learn to pinpoint the problems is by absorbing as much content as you can, because that's the thing now, it's not just watching movies, it's absorbing content, it's watching TV shows, it's watching movies, it's watching video essays on how they did this one thing. It's when I watch the movie, I research just on just even just a basic Wikipedia search of like production. What happened to make this possible? What stood in the way? What was the reception when it first came out?
Yeah.
And it's just trying to learn, gain as much knowledge as possible. Because I never wanted to be in a conversation, especially in the industry, where you're talking about something and I didn't know what they were talking about. You have to kind of stay on top of that. So I do think like you can impress people. I'm not saying I do it just to impress people, because I really want to learn this stuff, but it helps as a conversation starter. It's like when I was at an internship for a film festival, and they asked me, like, what's your favorite? Like, who's your favorite director? So I'm like, oh, I love Woody Allen, Charlie Chaplin. They're like, wait, how old are you? Like, I'm like, I'm 22. Like, you watch Charlie Chaplin and Woody Allen? I was like, oh, yeah, and John Hughes. I'm like, why? That you can get those where you're at in Alabama? I thought you just had, like, it was a one stoplight town or whatever. And I think you need to be able to know as much as you can. I feel like watching movies can be your own, like, personal film school. Because sometimes, like, I have professors that will show certain movies that I just don't like. But you try your best to learn from it. And you have to take it as a tool and not just entertainment, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess another way of, if it is,
I don't know if that answers your question at all.
No, it does. I mean, I'm grilling you now, Brandon.
No,
but if you're, you know, so you're talking about as a you know, consuming, yeah, as much, you know, are you looking for things that you liked? Like, you know, especially now that you've seen so many films, are you saying, like, do you watch trailers and say, like, no, I'm not going to watch that. I'm not going to learn anything from it. Like,
oh, no.
Are you watching Wedding Crashers 2, or yeah, it's just like,
yeah, I because I make a list of what I watch each year, and it'll be anything. It'll be San Andreas with The Rock, or it'll be a cult classic called I Drink Your Blood. And you might not learn a lot of stuff from all that, but you also kind of learn why people like it. Like, why is this a thing, if that makes sense? It's like, I know you, like, you talked about, or before, how you, like, will watch people on planes, like, when they're watching movies. And you see that more as,
I'm
like,
a creep.
Yeah,
I'm a,
no,
weirdo.
I do it too. And you do it more of, like, probably in a more analytical way of, like, does it tell the story? Like, do I learn that? I watch it go, oh, that person's watching that. They're watching that. And I start to notice trends. What's popular? Like, out of all these movies that's newly released or classics, on my last plane ride, it was Florence Foster Jenkins and Jason Bourne. That was it. Hmm. And I saw 15 different screens, and it was just kind of split down the middle. And
because they were the screens on the back of the seat, or people brought... Okay.
I could actually, like, watch people watching, and they're mostly all those movies. And then you had a few kind of other stuff in there, but, like, it was most of those two movies.
Yeah.
And then, like, before that, it was... Like, you just start to see the same movies pop up. And the thing is that those are not the top movies on the first screen. Those are stuff you search. So I'm like, why is that? And so I look at the trends and try to figure out why that's a popular movie. Even like in Florence Foster Jenkins, people have referenced that so many times. And I'm like, it didn't even do that well in theaters. Like, it did okay, but why is that movie being referenced? Like, my parents rented that on demand because they really wanted to see it. And I'm like, why is that? And so that's one big thing, especially if it has a following. Why I try to watch that. Why is that a big thing? Or, like, sometimes movies that are classic movies that I just don't like, I go, okay, well, and this is, I know I learned this from Mark, my cinematographer, who's also my roommate. It's like, if I didn't like it, why do other people like it? So you have to learn, especially if this is what you want to do, this is what you're committed to doing as a career, you have to know as much as possible. And I kind of take that, I learned that from when I played basketball, was like, I know Kevin Garnett, who's this phenomenal, like, power forward in basketball, always said he always kept practicing because he knew someone else out there was working harder than him.
Yeah, sure.
And that was kind of the same thing. I always knew someone was going to be watching more than me, so I had to keep watching as much as possible.
Yeah, and in a way, I mean, that's what I was saying earlier, where it's I kind of started to realize, like, at 27, 28, 29, 20, 30, where I'm going, you know, I'm not watching that many, and I don't, you know, again, with the way that my teaching, maybe this is a... my teaching philosophy affects my own life in a way, which is, you know, if you don't have that internal drive, what does that say about what you're trying to do, you know? And, So yeah, I mean, in a way, that made me kind of pull back from some of the some stuff. But so are you also then, like, because you're in LA? I mean, are you trying to hit up, you know, foreign films as much as possible in theaters? I mean, like, because to me, like, I hit a phase in college, I think, where I was like, okay, I really need, you know, and I still do this sometimes now, where I like, I have a huge gap in my film knowledge about, you know, 1960s Japanese cinema or something like that, right? Where I'm like, I need to fill this in with like, give me the classics, right? And I watched enough films to kind of like know what I like, don't like. And so in some ways I cut back because it's like, I don't need to see another Wedding Crashers 2, even though I like it from an entertainment standpoint. There's not necessarily this big like analytical thing to be gained, right? I mean, you're at some point you're just watching to be watching, you know. That was just my own thinking about it, you know.
You're putting stuff on that you don't have to think that much for. Like, I mean, that happens to me. Now I'm trying, that's one of my biggest things, that I don't watch as much foreign films, and I'll happily admit that. And I'm trying to get better at that. So like, I had the guys at Cinephile, like, before I left, they're like, you're taking these movies with you to watch, and you have to come back and tell us that you watched them. And so like, I have 10 movies that I've watched 3 or 4 of them. I watch one a day, and none of them have been foreign films I think I've watched so far. But they gave me foreign films to watch, and it's just, that's my weaker thing, so that's what I have to focus on. But I told my friend Matt, who works the story, he's like, oh, you don't watch enough foreign films. I go, yeah, that's true. I said, but if you tell me any American film after 1990, I bet you I've watched it. It's like, I can do, because we're like doing an Oscar thing at one time of like name the top grossing movies of each year. I was like, I have seen all of these from like 1991 to this time or whatever. I've seen like 75% of them. And so I'm very strong in that, in American films post like 80s and to present. But foreign films we get better at. And I know, I mean, the thing is, I watch stuff from the 1910s onward. It's not just I stop in the 70s and that's where the film was great and that's all I watch. I try to work as far back as possible.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I know, like, because Spielberg said in an interview one time how he was talking about how he talks to young filmmakers and how they know his films, they know Scorsese's film, they know Coppola's films, they know George Lucas's films and De Palma's, but before that, they know one.
Sure.
And so you forget George Cukor or Victor Fleming or Frank Capra or Fritz Lang or Hitchcock. You forget all, or John Ford. Like, you forget all these people. Yeah. And like Spielberg said, he goes, we learned from them. And we're just like almost a carbon copy of them. And they watch the silent film people. And so that's their master. So we learn from the master. So you should be going as far back as possible.
Yeah.
To where you have everything.
Which, in a way, I mean, as film moves forward, just in ages, in a way, you know,
yeah,
it gets more complicated. You know, people in 2030 or whatever going to film school will have that much more backlog to work through. And so I think at some point, if we aren't already here now with the number of, you know, we were talking about, like, you know, if it's not on Hulu, Netflix... Yeah. You know, film struck, if it's not in the movie, you know, if you go down that list and it's not there, then we probably weren't meant to see it.
Yeah.
I think we've already hit that phase where there's just so many, many things which are beyond what even, you know, you think about some of these filmmakers who grew up in the 70s, you know, who were making films in the 70s.
Yeah.
They were going to cinemas in the 50s and 60s in big cities in New York or L.A., and they would have had how many films available to them?
They didn't have many.
You know, many. And they would have seen them multiple times because they loved them, but they wouldn't have had this backlog of like, oh shit, I've got to watch like you know, thousands of films to become
that's a... That's on my queue. Or it's going off Amazon and next week.
Exactly. So I think there's a way to get stuck into like a vortex of like, I got to see it all before I can make something. I think that's clearly like a flawed premise because that wasn't how...
No.
Decades and decades, if not all of filmmakers until recently, operated, really, you know?
I know. I think Zemeckis talked about this in like an interview with Tarantino at one point. There's a great interview that someone sent me, a friend of mine, Jamie, who was in Camp Nickel. She sent me an interview with Tarantino and Zemeckis. I think Zemeckis talked about how like he found out at a certain age where he could actually just stay and watch the movie over and over again. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of young who became Spielbergers, Zemeckis or Scorsese, they would just stay in the theater and watch the same movie on loop. That's how they got to know it so well.
Yeah.
And that's the thing with now is that we watch it one time and move on.
Yeah.
And you can eat, they can all blend together, or it's like,
yeah. And I think that's the, what we started with in this whole thing, right? Which is like, yeah, the difference between just being entertained and being a film lover,
yeah,
which is a totally fine. Like that's yeah, what fuels all of this. You know, yeah, what I mean? All of like people like you and me who are watching films more obsessively than regular people, yeah, are funding Filmstruck or Netflix, yeah, or whatever. I mean, you know, we're like putting in the views to give all these people money. But if you are planning to actually do it, yeah, you're planning to make it, then you need to be one of those people that watches it more than just the once, the, yeah, twice, or the three times, but mm-hmm, the 5, 10, 15, 20 times, mm-hmm, to be able to say, like, that continuity error, yeah, is not an error. It's, no, there for a reason, choice, because of these things.
Yeah, you know? Have to understand film language,
yeah,
is the thing.
Yeah.
But even people who, like, don't know that, they have a subconscious understanding of when something's, sure, not working.
People know the vocabulary, and that's why you get, we're looping it all back around, yeah, to wrap it up, Brandon, but that's why you get those notes,
yeah,
that are like, this is broken, and mm-hmm, you're like, wait a minute, that's not broken.
No, no, no.
But they're telling you because you subconscious, broke the line, yeah, 3 minutes ago,
yeah,
or, you know, or the music cue is broken,
yeah,
you know, 5 minutes ago.
Yeah.
And they're telling you, like, this whole thing is set up with the wrong premise, and, or you didn't foreshadow it. You know, people, yeah, can't articulate that because they don't know, mm-hmm, what you didn't do, because they're not thinking about it holistically like you should be as a, yeah, filmmaker. But you have to take that, not hate the feedback.
No, no, no.
Use it and say, wait a minute, what could be wrong? Is it because if you get it more than once, that should be a big clue. Because people do, like you said, don't want to give harsh feedback or even feedback at all, really. People want to say, yeah, like, oh, great job. You're, yeah, the greatest. You're the next Spielberg. Yeah. You know, that's what people want to say because nobody, yeah, wants to offend you. But if you get a note twice, that should be like, ding, ding, ding. Yeah, like something's wrong. Really, really, yeah, wrong that you need to pay attention to because... And that was how some of those scenes were that I cut, where people were like, this is all wrong. And I was like, no, 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 I am right.
I'm right.
I'm right. And I wasn't right, Brandon.
But no one else was right, is the thing.
Tell us your thing. Let's wrap up. But your thing about counting shots and scenes.
Yeah.
We talked about watching them silently.
Yeah, yeah.
We said something else that was also really insightful and people can remember. but counting shots.
I count shots. And I did it beforehand, but I was in a class one night at USC, and I only had him for one night because of the internship interfered with it. He picked out a scene from a certain movie, and he's like, count how many setups there are, and then count how many shots. He goes, there is a difference between setups and shots. And he's like, there might be 15 shots, but there's 4 setups. So I count, like, okay, there's a shot there. And then at the end of the scene, I go, oh, there's 7 shots or whatever.
7 setups.
7 setups, basically.
Yeah.
And I go, okay, that's 7 setups. And I go, okay, well, the whole rule was like, how long that, I think, like, how long it took them or why they chose those 7. And just, I think about that. Or sometimes, like, it's usually like 4 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so you just have to learn. It's sometimes I do it with movies that I've watched many times before, because that just, it helps, like, okay, how did Woody Allen do it? How did Spielberg do it? And you realize that usually a lot of times there's not many shots in there.
Not many setups.
There's not many setups. So yeah, there's not many, yeah, setups in there. But like with Spielberg, there's a lot of shots because he does like a one-er and it's one setup. But the way he blocks it, there's close-up, medium close-up, 2-shot, whatever. But, and then sometimes when I'm bored in a movie that's not doing well, I just like to pass the time. Oh, 1, 2, 3, this might took them 2 hours to shoot because of,
yeah,
setups or what, like the setups and,
right,
the lighting. And because the rule that I was always told was like every setup should be 30 minutes. That depends on how,
totally, yeah,
on how fast you are. Because I early on when I started out, I think we shot like 50 setups in a day, which is like kind of impossible if you're on like a big film set.
Depending. Well, yeah, it just depends on how, yeah, much gear and people you have to move, right? If,
yeah,
the fewer, the more you know, yeah, the more you can shake things up.
Yeah, and so it's just something I do because it also, so like, how the shot progression. So it'd be like wide, close up, medium close up, reverse, and all that type of stuff. And so I see just how you cover a scene.
Yeah.
And how sometimes, and when you do that, you'll also start to learn, like, oh, they're not cutting at all. Because sometimes if it's a good filmmaker, you don't pay attention to the cuts. You don't pay attention to the shots or setups. You're just like, oh, this is a good scene. And then when you start looking, you're, oh, this is all one shot. Like, I think I was watching a little bit of Straight Outta Compton last night, and there's a shot. And I heard it was a one shot. I go, that wasn't a one shot. And then I watched it, and I'm like, no, that's a one shot. But you couldn't tell because the way the camera moved and the way we're able to create multiple shots in that one setup. Multiple shots in that one setup.
Yeah.
And you learn a lot from that, I feel. And you learn from a directing standpoint and a producer standpoint. I can go, okay, I could probably shoot that many in that amount of time.
I mean, in a lot of ways, right, you're trying to, like you said, vocabulary, really you're trying to build up your bag of tricks, right, to know what other people are doing, but also to say, like, okay, because there is so much similarity in, like, you know, and this is a thing that it's almost an exercise that I want to do someday. I guess I'm putting it on the podcast now, so I have to do it at some point. But, you know, it's like there's so many two people in a room talking, you know, or at a table having a conversation. And you see, the thing that I noticed a lot teaching is everybody wants to make this huge thing. They want to go out and make some big thing with zombies or whatever. And they would totally flub two people in a room talking. You know, because they wouldn't cut it, they wouldn't cover it right, they wouldn't, you know, they'd break the line, all these really simple things. And it's like, that is a really boring exercise.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I know that I messed up when I did the short film, I broke the line and I flubbed pretty simple, just structural staging, blocking, flipping around in the right way. And it's because, you know, it's just one of those blocking and tackling sort of things that you want to build up on its own. I don't know.
Okay, I mean, even sometimes, like, even though you might know it all, you get so busy with, like, in the midst of the set or whatever, you don't pay attention to how you shot the thing before or whatever, and then it can get lost. I mean, it's happened before with stuff I've done, and it's just like, oh, that's why it's messed up, because the shot, or they broke the line here, I didn't mean to, or that person's looking the wrong way, the screen direction's off.
Right.
So it's just when you watch so much, you try to make it to where it's a subconscious thing. It's like, and it's the whole thing of, like, I think Adam Salke told me, he was like, prep so much to where when you get to the set, you can, like, throw it out the window. And that's what a lot of directors say.
Yeah.
You just have to, you prep that much to where subconsciously later you can just go off the fly and know what you did, but create something new from it, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I mean, one of the best things that I did for that web series, which helped a lot, you know, I'm talking about scenes that had fluff.
Yeah.
But I cut out even more from the script by making a little animatic, which is Pixar thing in a lot of ways of just turning all of your shots from your shot sheet as a director into little drawings, voicing them out with the lines, cutting them back and forth in Final Cut or whatever you want on your phone. I mean, you know, you do it in the simplest way possible and you realize, like, oh my gosh, no matter how I frame this and how beautiful this looks, people are going to be bored as hell because you don't need this, you know, and you realize it once you read it, hear it, see it, you know? And so, yeah, it's that idea of just prepping it so much that you can break away from it. But
a quick story, and then we'll end it because we're going very long. We'll have to cut some of this out. They had one story where there was a scene in one of my last few movies that I did, and it was like a 3-page dialogue scene. It took place, you've seen the movie, it's in Hartley. It was like a 3-page dialogue scene, and it took place in a car. And I had one professor go, 3 pages of dialogue? Well, that's going to be visual. And it's like, in a car, it's like, oh, so I cut a page of it, and then I go, okay, how do I take this 2-person conversation in a closed off location and make it visual to where it's not just shot, shot, shot? And so you make a decision of, like, oh, break the line here, or have a close up, then have a medium to where you can, like, slam down the point you're trying to make.
Right.
So that's the big thing. But anyway, so that's the end of this episode, and it's a long one right now.
Brandon, this has been good, though.
It's been great. We did it in person.
Let's not do this again. Or at least for a long time.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We got to keep the mystery going between us.
Yeah, because we okay. Yeah, because we've only known each other for how long? So quick, very, very quick point. So recommendations.
Oh my gosh, people. Brandon, you go first. I'm not at all ready. I don't think I've seen. Go ahead.
Well, it had to be anything you see. Like, I was gonna talk about Childish Gambino's new album, which I think is great. I think it's "Awaken My Love" is the title of it. Anna brought up in the last episode. It's not really a rap album. It's a great album to check out. Donald Glover is one of the most talented guys out there, I think. One of the most talented people out there who can do so many different things. So, yeah, definitely check it out. iTunes, Spotify. I don't know how the kids listen to music all the time nowadays.
Google Play?
That's a thing. Yeah, I forgot.
Given to the overlords. I don't know. I mean, you picked music. I'll pick music. I really like Julian Baker. I don't know if you've heard of this person.
No, I haven't.
Singer-songwriter from Memphis.
I love anyone from Memphis.
She got featured by NPR, is how I heard about her months ago. This isn't a new thing. This is like 6 months ago or something.
Yeah.
But her album, Sprained Ankle, I'm still listening to it now.
Mm-hmm.
Good stuff. I mean, I bounce between Julian Baker and rap music, so I'm a really like...
You're Portland.
I'm a very messed up person, but
it's okay.
But it's a really great album. It's poignant, beautiful. This is a visual thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of the reason that she kind of blew up and got noticed by NPR and, you know,
mm-hmm.
whatever, was featured. Whoever she's working with, I don't know who this person is. I haven't done all the research. But, mm-hmm. right, they did these really great, not music videos, not live performances,
mm-hmm.
but music videos, basically, of her performing, like in parking lots.
Yeah.
Or, like, she's got, there's one series of videos where she's, like, in, like, a high school... Like an abandoned high school, like, stands. It's beautiful. It's like sunrise.
Yeah.
I'm like, guys, you're cheating. This is just gorgeous. But it's like two cameras,
her
with a mic. It's like the simplest setup, and mm-hmm. it's genius. So if you YouTube it probably instead of the album because it's really simple.
Okay.
But
have like a playlist of videos. Okay.
Julian Baker. We'll put it in the show notes.
We'll put it in the show notes. Okay. Well, so yeah, make sure you like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Cinemation Show. Subscribe to us on iTunes and make sure you give us a review because we'd like to hear what you guys have to say about us and if you hate us and if you want shorter, longer episodes. Or you can just rant to Ben about something at Sweet22 on Twitter.
You know what I'd love? Because I think some people that I, former students, this is how old I am, but former students listen to the show. You should write in and people have better memories than I do.
Uh-huh.
Tell me the dumb things that I said to you, but also potentially good things that I said because... I think it was Hunter that had a story for me the other night that we'll have to have him tell it on the show, but it was something I have no recollection of at all. And it was this like, you know, thing that he remembered like verbatim. And as he told us, like, yeah, that sounds exactly like something I would say.
I don't remember that.
I was frazzled most of the time when I walked into the classroom, but anyway.
But yeah, so Ben, thank you for meeting up with me in Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
Brandon,
this episode,
it's been lovely.
It's been fun. Thanks for the cheesecake. And guys, thank you.
I spoil you.
Thank you guys for listening. Hope you tune in to more episodes soon. Bye.